Thank you very much. And I have a report, and I'm going to request staff help me out with this report. But first off, I want to thank the community of Port Angeles, and this nice crowd is why we do come to places other than just Olympia. So thank you for coming out this morning and providing input. It's encouraging when we go to places out and around the state. We usually have bigger crowds than when we are in Olympia. So it's great to see you all and hear your concerns. I have a few items this morning. I already talked about the outfitters and guides information that I was going to mention that. As far as the halibut seasons go, we were able to implement some in-season management last year, and that's why we were able to extend that season. We're going to try to continue to do that. It's an expensive monitoring program, but we'll try to continue that. And I think Michelle Culver is here today too, so she can answer questions. So before I begin, I would like to introduce my staff. And why don't you introduce yourselves, and then if any of you have specific interests in these areas, you'll be able to contact staff at the break or whatever. So Penny, why don't we start with you and just go around real quick and introduce yourself and tell folks what your job is.
Rich Harris, I'm the section manager, and one of my jobs is to deal with outfits.
Hello, my name is Eric Neverman, and I'm the science division manager in the fish program.
Good morning, my name is Joe Anderson. I'm a research scientist. I do salmon and steelhead monitoring in Puget Sound.
Good morning. My name is Nate Kamplin. I'm the policy director for the department.
Good morning, I'm
Michelle
Culver. I manage ocean fisheries and the halibut
fisheries. Julie? Julie Sandberg,
real estate services manager,
transactions.
Okay, great.
If those people represent any areas that you're particularly interested in, please talk to those people at the breaks, and they'll make themselves available to answer your questions. I want to touch on a couple items, and then I'm going to ask staff to cover a few things in more detail. First thing I want to talk about is I like to be on the front page of the newspaper when it's things like record-breaking salmon seasons or fabulous elk hunting and those sorts of things. But unfortunately, the department's been on the front page a bit lately for some things that I'm not very proud of and that our employees have done in the past, some of them a couple years ago, from a sexual harassment standpoint, and some more recently at one of our hatcheries. I just wanted to acknowledge this and let the public know that the department takes these things very seriously. We let four people go at a Wells hatchery. There was a dynamic there of behavior that is not tolerated by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and won't be tolerated anywhere that I'm made aware of around the state with my employees. I expect a higher standard of acceptance, inclusion, and tolerance for diversity of all kinds. And so just wanted to make those comments in a public spot that the department takes these things seriously. And we're a great place to work, and we have had a handful of people that did not understand the rules of the road, and they're gone, and in the future they will be gone if they do the similar thing or other people do similar things. So that's about all I want to say about that. We've had several items that of specific nature that we're going to improve our training in this area. We're going to provide some opportunities for groups to work on diversity issues, and we're going to up our game in the department. And I think I would like to be an example of state government of how you deal with these issues and move forward. So anyway, I felt it was necessary to mention that. And with that, I think I'll move to a couple other issues. First, Nate, will you come up? And last year, we had a fee bill in the legislature. It did not pass, but the legislature did provide the department with an enhanced general fund budget. And so, but part of that, the legislature provided a proviso that asked or directed us to do some things. And Nate's going to talk about those and also talk about what we've done with our current budget and the rollbacks in a few areas. So go ahead, Nate.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. It's a pleasure to be here today. I lived for 3 years out in CQ and Clallam Bay, and it's nice to be back into town. This is always quite a drive just to come here to get groceries, and so it's fun to be back. So as Director Unsworth asked, I'll provide an update on the 17-19 operating budget and where we currently stand on trying to come up with a balanced budget for this biennium, and then talk about some of the proviso requirements that the legislature provided to us. We started this biennium with a what we call a structural deficit. That is a gap between the amount of spending authority that the legislature provides us and the revenue that we have, that we earn. And that amounts to a $15 million gap. In addition, we have a $12 million hole due to rising costs in federal grants that are not keeping up with inflation, new ESA requirements on hatcheries and fish management. And so that adds, that brings the total up to $27 million budget gap. The legislature did provide $10.1 million of one-time general fund for us to help close the gap, but they also directed the department to look for efficiencies, conduct an organization and management assessment, conduct a zero-based budget exercise, and essentially directed us to avoid taking cuts to hatcheries and minimize impacts to hunting and fishing. And so with that guidance, we looked at several, I'll kind of describe our solution in two areas. The first was some global aspects of budgeting that we took a look at and applied across the board. We currently try to, we usually manage the state wildlife account with a two-month working capital reserve. That is, we just try to set aside 2 months' worth of revenue to make sure that we have enough stability to go through the ups and downs of incoming revenue. We're going to be a little bit more assertive with that and just manage our budget towards a one-month working capital reserve for the purpose of this biennium. That provides a savings of $3.5 million. The second tool that we're going to apply is use a vacancy rate assumption across all six programs. And so this should provide us with $4.5 million worth of savings here, because oftentimes we don't spend all of our money. There is typically some revenue that accumulates and accrues towards the end of the biennium. What we're basically doing is looking at the level that's usually at the end in month 24 and going ahead and basically applying that reduction in the first couple months of the biennium. The third tool that we're using is we're making sure that we're applying administrative reductions across all the different restricted accounts, or administrative costs are applied to all the different restricted accounts. That helps provide $1.2 million in savings and avoids $1.2 million of direct cuts. And then finally, we're shifting some of our authority to different restricted accounts that have a positive account balance and making sure that those uses that we're using for that money are consistent with the purpose of that restricted account. And that brings us to another $2 million of savings. So in all total, that leaves us now with a $6 million hole when you apply the $10.1 million of one-time general fund as well as the $11 million of different savings and budget tools that I just reviewed. For the last $6 million, we've been looking at and working with through our executive management team. We've identified a number of management cuts. We've identified areas that we can reduce capacity for the agency to respond to emerging issues, such as if there's a severe winter, we'll have a reduced capacity to respond for elk winter feeding or providing compensation to landowners that experience damage. But we have enough set aside to kind of meet the average of previous year's expenditures in those types of areas, as well as we've identified other very deliberate delays of vacancy rate management for specific positions for either 6 month, 1 year, or holding that position vacant for 2 years. So I'll pause there and see if there's any questions about how we've approached thus far. And I would just say that for some of the other specifics, we're still working through that with our executive management team, and there's certainly some discussions with affected staff that we need to talk to those people.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your listing of savings, you mentioned $1.2 million for increased administrative costs, or raising the administrative costs to something. That sounds like increased spending more than it sounds like savings. So could you explain a little bit more what contracts or where is this? If you're raising the administrative costs, charging somebody else more, where does that more come from? Yeah.
Mr. McIsaac, I appreciate the opportunity to try to clarify that. What this is for a number of our restricted accounts, the funding is basically going to the direct activity. And so what we're looking at doing is having a small proportion of each account to have the administrative portion for management, central fiscal services within the agency that is consistent with sound budget management, of being able to tap in and apply essentially an indirect rate to a portion of each account, which then frees up non-restricted funds to backfill other areas. So it does become a cost-neutral way to provide savings. It doesn't result in direct cuts, and we're basically able to shift authority on to where those accounts have some balance. And I can tell by how I'm explaining this, I'm not doing a good job. So.
Can I follow? So you're saying that overhead indirects were not charged on all accounts?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Well, and I would say it was charged this. And indirect's probably not the best term, but I think it will work for now. Indirect was charged from the main business services program, but it was not applied to each program that helps manage that account. And so, for instance, if there was a restricted account on the two-pole endorsement, business services had a proportion of that for admin funding that was applied. We did not have FISH administration charged to that account. And yet there are staff that are also managing and conducting those same services. So we can apply and shift some of that administrative work from the programs onto those restricted accounts.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I was going to ask for maybe an example to help visualize this. So you just used one, the two-pole endorsement program. So if there's $100 that is in this two-pole endorsement program, and you're going to charge some amount of that $100 and recover it to solve this budget problem, does that short the two-pole endorsement program by that amount? And I'm still having a little bit of trouble visualizing how the math ends up at zero.
So if I could make up hypothetical numbers, maybe this will help. So say the account has $100 in it. Currently, our central budget business services program would have, let's say, $10 that goes towards administrative costs. This would now have the FISH program have, for instance, an additional $1 or $2 applied to that account. This is consistent with the Office of Financial Management's guidance on appropriate use of accounting. It's probably something that the department should have been doing for years, and this is an opportunity to apply it that does provide some savings elsewhere.
Yeah. I think, Nate, what I'm having problems understanding is where is the savings here? It's shifting money. Having a struggle trying to figure out where it comes out as savings.
By applying the authority and having, if FISH program previously had other accounts for their administrative, are now able to also tap into this restricted account in a way that's consistent with indirect practices, that then provides the bank shot for savings.
Thank you.
Suffice to say, it's complicated and perhaps counterintuitive.
Yes. Yes. And Commissioner Keeney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. You mentioned another savings area, cutting back to more of an average for instance, hay feeding of elk in hard winters. And wildlife damage. Was that specifically crop damage or all types of damage? Could it be livestock damage? And also, does that put us in the position of, if we did have harsh winters, needing to find those funds? Are those funds that you have to pay out if damage occurs? And then, I mean, I can understand the savings now, but in the end, would we still have to pay them if it occurred?
Okay. Commissioner Keeney, I appreciate the question. In the example that I used for the compensation, I had in mind a line item reduction associated with deer and elk crop claims. And yes, when we have the claims, we would need to pay those. So it would either be dealing with that emergency and looking for alternative ways to solve it in the moment, or going back to the legislature and seeking for a supplemental funding request.
Any other questions, commissioners? Somewhat related, you're talking about the operating budget. The capital budget is still not there. How is the department doing managing?
Thank you, Chair Thorburn. Yes, correct. We do not have a capital budget. The legislature did provide a reappropriations for capital work, so that's allowing certain staff in our capital asset management program to continue to work on projects that had carried forward. But in other areas, we're using operating dollars to try to sustain those staff. In some cases, we think we can keep folks on through this winter, and certainly hope when the legislature comes back this winter, we'll have a capital budget.
Thank you. Okay.
So with that, I'll shift to the proviso that was in our operating budget. The legislature directed us to look and evaluate and implement efficiencies to the agency's operations and management practices, develop a plan for balancing our budget, as well as conduct a zero-based budget review. So on the first item of the proviso with the management and organization assessment, we had a request for proposals that was out for pretty much the month of August that is closed, and we're now in the final portion of working with the potential vendor to come up with a contract. So hopefully we'll have this organization and management assessment vendor under contract here in the next week or two, and that will kick off. The legislature asked for this organization assessment to be completed by May 1st. We wanted to have the results of that review done earlier, and so our target is to have that completed in January so that we can have that information and those efficiencies that have been identified to help us as we inform our budget proposal development for next spring. The second area is the legislature asked it to come up with a long-term plan to stabilize the budget for 1921, including looking at new revenue options and making sure that we have broad stakeholder and legislative support. We have a second RFP out for that vendor. It was just released on September 1st, and we'll hopefully have somebody in place to help us with those efforts by early October. In addition, we're going to be creating a new budget and policy advisory group composed of diverse stakeholders to help us with the zero-based budgeting as well as the long-term plan for looking at revenue options. So that invite letter I'm hoping will go out next week, and hoping to have the first meeting with that new advisory group in November. And then finally, we have staff that are working on researching different methodologies for the zero-based budgeting approach. It can be very complicated on how that process is completed. We're looking at having essentially kind of mocking up what we think the end product might look like so that we can then work towards that goal as we apply those techniques across the entire operating budget. I would just point out two other items that within the strategic plan and director's performance agreement that you'll have on your agenda later today. We've really tried to focus those down to implementation of the proviso and making sure that those tasks are front and center with you, as well as we have our first quarterly report to the legislature at the end of this month on our status of how we're doing with the proviso.
Chair, Nate mentioned the three parts of the proviso, the first being the management and organizational review. That contract allows for some interviews to occur, and I think we set aside five interviews for commission members, and so I'm looking for five commissioners who are interested in being part of that process. It would involve probably just one less than an hour sort of interview, but if you're interested, let me know, and I'll contact the other three commissioners that aren't here.
Thank you. Any other questions for
me? Thank you. Okay, thank you. The next item for the director's report, I would like to address some of the issues around the Atlantic salmon net pen collapse. We were notified of that collapse over a weekend, and initially our notification involved about 5,000 fish. It soon became evident by the first part of the week that it was a much bigger problem than that when fish started showing up everywhere. At that time, other state agencies, Department of Ecology, and ourselves and several tribes began responding and trying to work on plans to recover fish. We established a incident command center in Anacortes and manned that for about 10 days. But our initial priority was to recover as many fish as we could. And the next other priorities for the department were to determine the health status of these fish and what impacts they would have on wild fish, and then certainly collaborate with tribal governments in order to recover fish while paying attention to ESA limits on listed species. So I'm going to ask Ron and Amy to help me out with this issue. Amy was our incident command leader in Anacortes, and Amy's the new Region 4 director out of Mill Creek. So, Ron, I think you're going to start first and then Amy. So.
So there is a slideshow playing, Amy reminds me. So these are photos that were obtained by the Unified Incident Command. I will, commissioners, I'll just jump right into the fish out of water section that the director spoke to. As of yesterday, I had 2,825 Atlantic salmon captured by non-treaty commercial fishermen. Most of that was landed in a smelt fishery. We had modified the regulations to allow the smelt fishers that we had out to land Atlantic salmon, often fishing in shallower water, and so that occurred. We did start a self-reporting website on the agency's site, and recreational anglers have self-reported 1,731 Atlantic salmon caught. Very broad range of where those are being caught, and think we'll get into that in a bit. And then the largest number from the treaty commercial fisheries, 49,892, mainly by the Lummi tribe. That was a total of 54,448 fish. We know that about half of the 305,000 fish escaped and were not extracted, so that'll give you a sense of the magnitude of what is still out there. So throughout this, we focused on aspects of getting these fish out of the water, First, working with Cook to ensure that the fish extraction from the pens occurred in an efficient manner without allowing additional fish to be released into the system. And then secondly, we had commitments that we'd made through North Falcon that we have our Endangered Species Act limitations. So along with our forecasts and negotiated fisheries with co-managers. So keeping all of those things in mind, promoting fisheries that through social media, other aspects, to go in and try to offer areas, gear changes, times, extensions of fisheries to allow additional capture of Atlantic salmon. And then tracking those fish, again, as they came out of the water, fish caught by all the commercial fishermen, both state and tribal fisheries, everything's reported onto a fish ticket. The recreational fishery, again, through a self-report. We don't have the regulations or on our catch record cards area where we had an opportunity to require them to report Atlantic salmon being caught. So just had them self-report onto the website. The other piece that I'll cover is ensuring the health fish, the health of the fish that were there. Our veterinarians have obtained fish prior to their extraction from net pens to do fish health work, histology and virology on those. Not all of that virology work is done and will be done by the end of the month, but everything else is within the normal known pathogens that we'd see in any freshwater or marine environment that fish have. Nothing out of the ordinary. In those particular instances, normal bacteria, those types of things, and we'll continue to report and share all that information as time goes on, both on the DNR website under the Atlantic section that they have put up, as well as sharing with our Canadian counterparts. We've been communicating with them on an ongoing basis, contacts that we have through the Pacific Salmon Commission process. So I'll just close with, and I can't remember if you covered this, so fish being caught down to the Nisqually Delta, up as far as about a quarter of the way up the east side of Vancouver Island, and then we had fish reported being caught in the Area 4, Marine Area 4 in the ocean, in the treaty troll fishery. So about 100-mile swing of migration from these fish, and I'll turn it over to our incident commander.
Okay, so my name's Amy Windrop. Thanks so much. Nice to be here today with you all. So the director talked about sort of our key priorities at incident command. They were the fish out of the water, make sure the fish are healthy to eat, and then understand the impacts to our local salmon populations. And so the things that we were most interested in immediately after the spill was, were these fish eating our native population? So we gathered fish from various fisheries and have checked stomachs. We've checked 26 stomachs as of this point, and all the stomachs have been empty. We also had a question from Cook Aquaculture about whether or not these fish that we were catching were actually their fish. And so every Cook Aquaculture fish that enters our waters is tagged on their otolith with a little thermal mark. And so we can know we can know with certainty that these fish came from Cook. So we've begun the process of reading the otoliths. All the fish at this point are from Cook. One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, there was a dispersal slide that came up that showed the fish going up into Canada. And so one of the questions that Cook had was, well, you know, that we have pens in Canada as well. How do we know those fish are from this escape? Canada does not require an otolith mark. And so all marked fish that show up are going to be from this particular spill. So moving forward, there is a lot of concern among the department and with our co-managers about the impact of these fish reaching the tributaries and going up into the tributaries. And so Ron did a great job of getting his staff on board to come up with a monitoring plan moving forward. That monitoring plan is out for review with our co-managers. They're also coming up with their own set of plans based watershed by watershed, which will dovetail with our plan. So moving forward, we had a couple of key questions. The first one was, are the escaped Atlantic salmon showing up in fisheries, on the spawning grounds, in fish traps, and at hatcheries? What is the sex and maturity status of the individual fish observed? Number two, have these fish been eating since the escape? And if so, what are they eating? Number three, have the fish grown since the escape? Number four, are the observed Atlantics confirmed to be Cook aquaculture escapees? And number five, have the escaped Atlantics picked up parasites and other diseases compared to Pacific salmon counterparts in the same location? So by answering those questions, we'll be able to understand if they're showing up on the spawning grounds, what the state of them are in the spawning grounds, and be able to give a much stronger answer to what is the impact of this escape to our native populations. And then finally, and maybe most importantly, is the relationship that we strengthened and continued to grow with our co-managers through this experience. The co-managers were, of course, really frustrated and angry with the escape, but I would say that the response from the co-managers, in particular the Lummi Nation, was really quite extraordinary. They came to incident command. They sat with us. They gave us a liaison. They were right there with us through this whole thing. And we are enormously appreciative of their effort and have worked hard to, you know, make sure they are absolutely partners in this. And moving forward, as we move into the investigation, we hope to have them engaged there as well.
All right, thank you. Now, so it becomes a moving forward issue, and what do we do? And now's the time to evaluate and determine exactly the cause of the collapse. And there's, that investigation is going on, and the department's an active participant in that. Also, this is a time to reflect on the regulatory status as currently exists, and it's an opportunity for the state legislature and other policymakers to determine what this industry means to the state of Washington, and if it remains, what kind of regulation needs to be improved for it to move forward and for us not to have these kind of escapes into the future. So there's going to be a lot going on over the next several months. The original statutes related to this were developed in the 1980s, actually at a time when there were no listed fish in the state. So lots has changed since the initial design of these regulations and rules. There's certainly, this event has highlighted some areas where I think the state needs to increase their oversight, and we need to look at our monitoring and licensing and permitting, and I think the state can do a better job if the industry is going to remain here. So an opportunity, and we'll see. I think we're doing the right kinds of monitoring we need to do on the disease and other parts of this. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the very nice presentation, and thanks for all the work the staff has done cutting regulations and a variety of those kind of things. It's a lot of work, and it takes days to do that. My question has to do with emergency authority to do something quickly. So scratching down my numbers here of 355,000 were in the pen, and maybe about half of them escaped. That's about 124,000, and you've accounted for 54,000. So more than half are still out there somewhere. Imagine some of them have died on their own, and some of them have gone 100 miles to the west. That's not that encouraging unless they keep going all the way out to the warm water. But it was mentioned to me that maybe a very quick response right after the escape happened, when maybe there was a large school of net pen fish swimming around wondering what to do next, with some the folks in the area that might know how to use a purse seine and circle a great big school and catch more than half of them within a few hours. Is there any emergency authority for a genuine emergency where the director can do something without having to spend days with a whole bunch of people cutting regulations and maybe have captured just a whole bunch of them within the next few hours after it was done? Or if you're looking to the future as to if this ever happens again, you know, as an extreme, if every one of those outfits had to have a little purse seiner right there in case they all get out and they are, part of their permit is they got to go out and start making some sets right away. So my question is there no emergency authority for the director to act in this kind of a genuine emergency? Are your hands really tied? And if that's true, has there been any thinking about how to get them untied so that some quick thinking will be applied?
I think the answer is that, yes, there is some emergency authority, but we're also limited in this particular area partly by Fraser River requirements. So, Ron, can you speak to the commissioner's concern?
So, Commissioner McIsaac, thank you for the question. One of the things that we heard is not to necessarily go back in and purse up everything real quick, but try to contract with purse seiners to contain everything within the bay that they were in. So another containment. That's a very intriguing question or idea. What we were faced with, and director's correct, my understanding of the emergency regulations is we certainly have the ability to put something in place to modify our fisheries. We have to do that by communicating with our co-managers and doing it within the constraints of our ESA guidance. And then to add another layer of complexity is that particular area through this time of the year and its fisheries, because of the possible presence of sockeye pinks, is under the Fraser panel. And it was a co-manager international fishery to where we had to go and talk to everyone involved to make sure that we could offer these fisheries in conjunction with the Pacific Salmon Treaty implementation and annexes or chapters of that treaty. So I think that we will, one of the things that we've talked about recently is that part of the work that we do is a fish prevention, a spill prevention plan, and a recovery plan. And then DOE attaches that to their NPDES permit that they issue under the water quality provisions that they have authority for. And them doing that then gives them some hammer where we don't have a hammer for a violation. And what we will be doing is looking at those two things. We followed that pretty closely in its priority order, but also realized that it was inadequate for the situation that occurred and that we have to broaden our thinking. It's been quite some time since we've had Atlantic salmon spills. We had one about 9 years ago. Prior to that, it was back in the 90s. We had 3 years in a row where we had Atlantic salmon releases, and so we haven't had them as frequently as some of the other operators north of us in Canada, but know that we need to beef our plans up to modern day and with the experience that we just gained from this Atlantic spill.
So Cook is, so the state is not involved in negotiations between the tribes and the Cook Aquaculture. So we can't, I don't really know. I know that they're talking, but I don't know what the results of the negotiations will be.
Well, I'm sure
the
commissioners
would
agree that
the commission
expresses our
gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
This director's report is taking quite a bit of time this morning, but we've had several important items, so I think that it's important. The other item I wanted to mention was In end of August, August 28th, we received a letter from the Douglas Public Utilities District informing us that they would like to discontinue the contract that we've had to operate the Wells Hatchery and three other facilities in the Upper Columbia. We have, myself, Ron, and others traveled to Wenatchee on the 1st of September to visit with the PUD, and since yesterday I provided them a letter in response to their request to terminate. We believe that there's good reason for us to stay on board and continue to operate those hatcheries, and we also acknowledge that this is a much broader decision than a unilateral decision for one PUD, and it includes our co-managers in the Upper Columbia, as well as NOAA and several people, and that we ought to have a broader discussion, and certainly 90 days is an unreasonable timeline to do this. The department has turned over hatchery management to other entities in the past, and there are sometimes some very good reasons to do that. And so we believe that the discussion is appropriate, and we're not afraid to have that. PUDs in the past have looked into this. They believe that there's a possibility to save money. It's a bottom-line issue for them. And they have looked at it in the past, and it hasn't penciled out. This decision was made partly due to the harassment issues over there, but also I think that there's a monetary issue, and it's something that the PUD has thought about for some time. Anyway, we're working. My letter back proposed to them that we finish out this year of contract, and we talk about it over the next 10 months and decide if it makes sense for the PUD, if it's a path forward, and we can maintain and keep the high quality of fish that we've been providing to that system and support for sportsmen and co-managers in the area, and also fulfill our conservation needs and meeting ESA requirements. So that's where we're at right now. I haven't heard a response from the PUD to my letter, but like I said, just sent yesterday. So a brief update and more on that as we learn some things. The Wolf update, instead of calling Eric up, I think I'll just give that. We continue to have some livestock depredation issues. We've had mostly two packs involved. One was the Smackout pack. The department removed two wolves from that pack. The operator had removed one wolf in protection of his livestock. We've been carefully monitoring that group since, and we haven't had any more issues in that pack. We had additional problems with the Sherman pack. It's a very small pack, and we removed one wolf from that pack, and now we're in the monitoring phase to see if there's any more issues there. We just had two confirmed livestock attacks down in the Assotin County, and so we're monitoring that right now to determine, to make sure that the non-lethal protocols are in place, and we're doing what we can to help those operators in that area. So that's in a nutshell. I don't know, Eric, if you need to add any more, but that's where we're at on the wolf front.
I think you got it, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So with that, I'll conclude the director's report, and if there's any questions for Joe and I or Nate or others, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Director. We are